Welcome one and all to the AirPod for a slightly different episode this week. We are seeing out the year in style. Maggie Rooley, how are you doing?
Hello, hello. Happy almost new year.
Happy almost new year to you. I am very well fed. I've had quite a nice Christmas break. I'm feeling very relaxed. I have just about managed to pull the last 12 months together in my mind because it has been a lot.
It's hard to believe all that's happened in 12 months. We're going to go through it here in a second. And when we start talking about some of the major news stories, it feels like they were maybe a decade ago.
It really does. I mean, it's been a tumultuous year, I think, for most people, but certainly the royal family, who have had to navigate new ground and deal with crises, not just in the nation, but also on the home front too. And some has been handled flawlessly and some not so much. So we will be joined very shortly by ABC News producer Zoe McGee, who is the woman behind much of the royal content that you guys see on ABC News and Good Morning America. And so it'll be good fun to chat with her. Maggie, before we start, what is the one thing that stands out to you as kind of the big milestone for the royal family this year?
Oh my gosh, that's a tough one. I mean, I think I almost have, oh God. You know what's funny is that if we had talked about this at the beginning of the year, we would have said Harry and Meghan leaving as working members of the royal family is definitely the largest story to happen in the last, you know, couple decades. How could anything top that? Yet that feels like a lifetime ago. And now royals dealing with the pandemic feels like the biggest story to happen in their lifetime. So it's funny. When you ask me this, now we're back in January. Now I'm going to say how the royals responded to the pandemic, but 11 months ago, I would have said Harry and Meghan leaving the UK.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think from Harry and Meghan moving to LA to Prince Charles testing positive for COVID-19, it's certainly been a year of royal firsts and a difficult year for everyone. But cast your minds back, listeners, to the start of the year and take a journey with Maggie, Omid and Zoe to look back at the royal year in 2020. Well, as I mentioned at the start of the show, there is only one reason we are all together this week, and that is to look back on a year that I think the word unprecedented has been used more than ever. And I'm very happy.
In an unprecedented way.
Exactly. And I'm very happy to have an extra addition to the crew this week. We have the wonderful Lady Zoe McGee, producer at the ABC News London Bureau, and of course our resident Royals producer expert. Can I call you an expert?
Yeah.
I like the title Princess. Princess Lady McGee.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a few more. Maybe Queen, Empress, Princess.
Ooh, that's nice. That's nice. It has a good ring to it.
Yeah. Well, it certainly has been a year where we've talked about titles more than ever. And I think kind of on that note, there's really no other story to talk about before anything else other than Harry and Meghan's exit from the royal family. We started the year really with this story, and we're still talking about it towards the end. It has dominated it. I think Google said that Harry and Meghan were the most, I think, in the top 10 most searched for figures in the world this year, and it shows just how much interest there was in their decision to step back.
I have a question for both of you. Do you remember where you were when you heard that they were actually going to leave?
Ooh, good question. Do you remember, Omid?
I do. Well, of course, there'd been so much talk behind the scenes. I was obviously in the middle of working on Finding Freedom at the time, which we'll talk about later in the show. And so I'd already had a good idea that something was happening. And of course, there was a lot of talk within the palace about it too. When Harry and Meghan came over to the UK, we knew that some sort of decision would be made. But I think finding out just after the visit to the Canadian embassy, of course, the couple had been staying in Canada. They'd come back for this supposedly a thank you to the Canadian government for being such hospitable hosts and for the people of Canada being so warm and welcoming to them. But of course, the backstory to this was that Harry and Meghan were, of course, planning to announce this major decision to step back. And I think for anyone, Zoe, you'll probably agree with me on this, for anyone that's been sort of was embedded in this beat at the time, it was something that we were all talking about behind the scenes. We just, it was a case of sort of how and when.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I still think it was quite shocking because I remember when they came back and they went to that, you know, the event at Canada House, and I was a bit like, why are they going straight to Canada House? And then there was something just didn't feel quite right about it all. And then I remember I was, because I was actually quite unwell for some of this year. So I was in bed. It was early evening and I was in bed. And I looked and suddenly, ping, all these alerts and my phone was going off. And I was just like, what's going on? And I read the email and I had to read it about three times. So I was like, oh my God, they're actually leaving. This is it. Mm. Because also before the Canada House thing, there'd been this story in The Sun, which was a leak. And we weren't sure whether it was a leak or whether, I mean, it's The Sun, it's a tabloid. Sometimes it gets things wonderfully right and sometimes it gets things wonderfully wrong. So it was one of those, like, are they? So as you say, we were sort of expecting it, but still, when it came, I remember being quite shocked.
Mm. Yeah, the most like expected, unexpected thing to happen. You know, what was funny for me is that I'm thinking back now to the other, to when this happened in early January, you know, it was like just entering 2020. No one knew what we were in for this year. And I was actually still in Australia covering the wildfires. So I was like, you know, half a world away from London at the time. But what was so surprising is that, you know, another Commonwealth country, people were still talking about it there. It was still something that, you know, was making headlines. People were buzzing about it everywhere you went. So I think it also goes to show just how global this was. You know, it happened to Harry and Meghan. It happened to the royal family in London. But this was something that people talked about really around the world.
I am just on that note, and this is a very silly aside, but I also watched some trashy TV during my convalescence, and even Bollywood Wives was talking about.
Really? So it was everywhere.
Yeah.
I think what was interesting about that time was, of course, Harry and Meghan didn't even know what was going to happen next. Mm. They'd obviously hoped to carve out a role within the establishment, and one that the establishment had never even seen before, this sort of hybrid position where they would choose which formal positions they would keep and what they would leave behind whilst developing their own private income streams and independence. And of course, this all happened very publicly. You know, we had the Sussex Royal
and
website.
And in a rush as well.
It was, yeah, it was, it felt, and I think it kind of then went to explain why this Canada House visit all happened very quickly. And I think for anyone that hasn't heard this, and I don't think anyone would know, we have a Royal WhatsApp group. There is and at the time, it was, of course, where we would often, as reporters, ask questions about any of the sort of stories surrounding the Sussexes, and whether they were true or not. The tabloids were filled with rumours every day. And I think that was almost the time when that group went quiet because there was no answers. There was nothing to share. And even within the institution of the monarchy, no one really knew how to navigate this half-in, half-out model that the couple wanted to proceed with, despite their best wishes and putting it all out there on the Sussex Royal website. And this was something that sort of continued or sort of hung over this story for quite some time until, of course, we had the famous Sandringham summit later on, which, you know, Meghan had flown back to Canada at this point, and Harry, with his sort of trusted aides in tow, had this incredible moment with his grandmother and his brother and his father to really sort of thrash out a deal. And, you know, we know now, looking back, just how difficult that was for him.
And we know now, not only was it difficult with him, but how bad things had got between the family and between everyone else, especially the brothers. I mean, there was that the sort of unconfirmed reports that Prince William, or maybe confirmed, maybe Omid, you know for a fact that Prince William refused to have lunch with his brother because he was just so livid with how he'd gone about presenting this all to the public as a fait accompli when, you know, it was a private matter that really, really should have been discussed behind closed doors before everyone else knew about it.
Yeah, and here sort of lied the biggest issue, was that there were already sort of strains in this relationship. Harry and Meghan, as we know, felt incredibly unsupported by the institution for quite some time. And I think the sort of first signs of that that came out were around the South Africa tour the year before, where we sort of found that they had sort of felt quite alone in their difficulties with the British tabloids. But of course, things only got worse when a lot of this then, with all of this decision to step back, happened very publicly. And as you say, it put William in a position where he didn't even want to really interact with his brother. And I think we really saw that, all the emotions from that, come out from Harry much later on in March, when he gave that almost a farewell speech.
The decision that I have made for my wife and I to step back is not one I made lightly. It was so many months of talks after so many years of challenges. And I know I haven't always gotten it right, but as far as this goes, there really was no other option. What I want to make clear is, we're not walking away. And we certainly aren't walking away from you. Our hope was to continue serving the Queen, the Commonwealth, and my military associations, but without public funding. Unfortunately, that wasn't possible. I've accepted this, knowing that it doesn't change who I am or how committed I am. But I hope that helps you understand what it had come to, that I would step my family back from all I have ever known, to take a step forward into what I hope can be a more peaceful life.
The echoes of that, which I was really struck by, was the echoes of his mother, who gave a very similar speech when she started to step back from royal duties. It was all, quite emotional, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think for everyone, not just for the couple themselves, but anyone that had been working around the couple for the sort of time that they had that office within Buckingham Palace. It was a surreal time for everyone. And I know I've spoken about this before, but of course, at the end of March, when they did actually step away from their roles, the deal had been sorted out as best as it can be. And it, of course, we had found out already in January that it was kind of untenable for them to have this hybrid working model, and that if they were going to be out, they would be out completely. And I remember being at Buckingham Palace for Meghan's last engagement, and just how emotional that moment was, not just for the Duchess, but also for the staff that had been working for her, and seeing those sort of final goodbyes. You really realise how hard this moment hit everyone, not just the family, but everyone within that institution that cared for the couple. Because, of course, as we know, and as I uncovered in much of it within Finding Freedom, there were also many that did not have their best interests at heart too.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I remember you telling me about that, Elmwood, those moments that were so emotional, and you were there for a lot of them, you know, Meghan's sort of last event as a working royal. And what struck me so much about the stories you told and, you know, hearing about it was, you know, something you just said, Zoe, that often we hear tabloid stories, perhaps, and I sort of always assumed the vast majority aren't true. You know, I came to this beat a little over a year ago, and I was under the assumption that most of what you heard probably wasn't true, and they must all get along in their family, and, like, you know, I'm sure it's all fine. And then to sort of have more and more sources reveal that there are a lot of problems going on behind the scenes, and perhaps it is really this emotional. And then to know that they actually take a step back, they make that choice to leave, that unprecedented choice, you know, to leave the royal family as working royals. It just reminded you the breaking point that they must have felt that the whole family was at, and how high emotions were running, and just really how unfortunate it is at the end of the day, you know, this is a family, and to have it be so raw and visceral and emotional, and then to see it sort of play out on a public stage, it was a rough time.
Yeah, it was a lot. It really was. What was the quote from Meghan in South Africa? It's not enough to survive. Mm-hmm. You want to thrive. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, they've gone off, and I would say they probably are thriving from all the deals that are being struck left, right, and centre. From what we see of them, they all seem very happy in their new Californian. It's pretty nice, pal. I wouldn't say no to living there.
Yeah, I agree. I could get behind that. Should we relocate this podcast to Southern California?
Frankly, I think we could probably live in that, you know, in the little kiddies house that was in their Christmas card. I'd be quite happy in that.
That's a really good point. Yeah, we're volunteering.
Yeah.
Well, of course, we came out of Harry and Meghan's departure and almost went into really one of the biggest crises that the world, this country, and the royal family has faced in quite some time, and a time where we really saw what I would call royal resilience. The royal family stepped up as the sort of cases and deaths from the coronavirus pandemic continued to spread across the UK and spiral in April. There was, of course, much criticism about how our Prime Minister Boris Johnson was handling the situation. And there was really only one voice that could unify a nation during what was an incredibly traumatic time for everyone. And, of course, we had the Queen address the nation in a televised speech, really one of her third, I believe, that was sort of outside of the usual Christmas speeches that we get. And again, unprecedented moment for the royal family, but one where we really saw the royal family step up in a way that we hadn't for some time.
While we have faced challenges before, this one is different. This time we join with all nations across the globe in a common endeavour, using the great advances of science and our instinctive compassion to heal. We will succeed, and that success will belong to every one of us. We should take comfort that while we may have more still to endure, better days will return. We will be with our friends again. We will be with our families again. We will meet again.
Yeah, I mean, that speech by the Queen was beautifully put. I mean, as usual, Her Majesty got it spot on, especially that closing line of "we will meet again." And actually, I don't know whether everyone saw it, but there was a huge billboard of her on Piccadilly Circus with those words next to it. And I think, you know, quite a few people would have taken a lot of comfort from looking up and seeing this sort of gigantic monarch looking down on them, telling them that, you know, we will meet again and we'll be okay. We just got to get through this. And, of course, you know, Queen Elizabeth II has been through a lot, and she has been through the Second World War, and she knows she's the emblem of the British fighting spirit, really.
It was a note of hope that I think so many Brits needed to hear. But what really surprised me at the time was that, of course, this message or her words didn't just reach those in the UK and across the Commonwealth. It was breaking news around the world. And, of course, I remember it was also a huge story on ABC News as well. And I think for everyone, it was that sort of reassuring acknowledgement of the hardships that society was facing at that time. And so whilst she is not the queen of many of the countries covering that story, she was still an apolitical figure that has, of course, been through so much, being able to sort of reassure us at a time when really we had no idea what was truly going on or how long this would last for. And, you know, I certainly never in my wildest dreams thought we would still be dealing with the pandemic on such a severe level at this point.
Yeah. I think the timing was so interesting, right? And I don't think I quite realized that until just this moment where we're coming out of, you know, this exit of Harry and Meghan. And I think there was so much conversation around sort of what's the point of the monarchy. And I know, as, you know, an American new to sort of living in a country with the royal family and experiencing it in a brand new way, there were definitely a lot of those questions, right? You had Harry and Meghan leaving the royal family as working members, many people questioning, you know, what sort of the purpose of the monarchy, what are they still doing? Is it still relevant? And then you have this massive crisis hit, and all of a sudden the Queen is speaking and the whole world sort of stops to listen. And for me, it really struck me as this poignant moment where you're like, oh, gosh, well, this is kind of the point of the monarchy. I mean, right here, right now, right? Like you said, world leaders, you know, elected politicians were all trying to rally their countries, but it was this queen that kind of silenced everyone and caused the world to stop and listen. And to have that happen so soon to when Harry and Meghan sort of had their, you know, big exit from the royal family, I think that juxtaposition was just very jarring.
No, that's a really good point. And also, it was quite interesting because all around, obviously, there are lots of kings and queens around Europe who are heads of state. But Queen Elizabeth held her fire because Sweden, you know, Spain, they were all quite early on going, you know, we'll get through this, we'll get through this. But and we were going, when's the Queen going to speak? When's the Queen going to speak? But and she timed it. She held her fire and she timed it very well for maximum effect.
Yeah, it was.
She knows what she's doing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it was You know, I think many would have been forgiven for thinking that the Queen's 90s would have been a quieter time as she, you know, moved away from some of the roles that she had. But I think this moment really reasserted her role as this very hands-on leader and also set the tone for how the royal family really continued their work throughout the pandemic. Because, of course, around this time, we saw that sudden shift into, you know, video calls and like everyone else that was sort of moving into this work from home model, they were doing exactly the same. But of course, it wasn't just the Queen's voice that carried so much weight within this pandemic. Prince Charles was of course really the symbol of how anyone could really be touched by COVID-19 at the time. And he was one of the most high profile figures in March,
and he was early on as well. Exactly, it was one of those. Oh my! I remember that phone call. Of like, Zoe, there are reports that Prince Charles has tested positive. I was like, no way! He was up in Scotland, wasn't he? And the extraordinary thing about that is that his wife didn't get it, nor did any member of his staff. So they must have isolated him pretty quickly. And it always made me giggle, the idea of sort of Prince Charles in some bedroom in Birkwall up in Scotland, having, you know, his food left outside and no one having anything to do with him. Because at that time, I think, wasn't the guidance 14 days?
Yes, it was a much longer period.
Well, no, what I was going to say is it wasn't just Prince Charles who of the royal family who came down with the virus, was it?
No. Well, what was interesting about this was, of course, as the UK really reached new heights within the fight against coronavirus, we found out much later on, in fact, only just a few months ago, that in April, Prince William privately battles the coronavirus for a positive test for coronavirus. And very little information has really ever come out about that ever since. It was perhaps one of the few moments this year during the pandemic where I think questions were sort of raised about how the royal family had perhaps conducted everything during that time, because I think we all saw the impact that Prince Charles's diagnosis had on the nation. And in fact, I think at a time when the Queen had later on told that, or reminded the nation that we must stay at home, and people were still coming to grips with this, I think seeing Prince Charles touched by COVID-19 was actually a stark reminder that it can happen to anyone, including your own parents, because I think he is sort of the dad of the royal family, and that to see him deal with that by himself at Birkhall, as you say, Zoe, would have been a reminder to everyone else that it could happen to their own families.
The other thing that I think the Queen carried off with great aplomb was when we first saw her in a mask when she went to go and lay some flowers on the tomb of the unknown soldier. She rocked it. She looked seriously cool, because there'd been a few engagements where everyone was kind of like, is she going to wear a mask? Isn't she going to wear a mask? And if you remember, she went with William to Porton Down, which is our sort of top secret chemical warfare facility in southwest of London. And she didn't wear a mask. And there was a bit of a rumble, like, why didn't she wear a mask? Because that would have been a really good message to the nation, wear a mask. And it turned out that everyone that she came in touch with had been tested, you know, well advanced of her trip and isolated, and so there was no way that anyone could have given her the virus. And I think probably at that time the biggest priority was to protect the monarch, and if she's going to go out and about, then, you know, mask or no mask, the most important thing is to make sure that she doesn't come in touch with anyone who's got the virus. But I personally think she missed a trick there.
Yeah, I think there are definitely moments this year where, for a family that is so concerned or sort of aware of optics, I think that's sort of really one of the main things that goes into the planning of any royal engagements. There were certain moments, such as not wearing masks on the visit that you refer to, that could have sent a really strong message to a country that perhaps wasn't completely unified on its thoughts on wearing a mask or not. But it didn't happen. And I think, like everyone, I think the royal family has really had to figure a lot of this stuff out as they move forwards. You know, the people advising members of the royal family have not dealt with a pandemic before, and I think that there are many firsts throughout this journey that perhaps haven't always been carried out flawlessly, but have eventually been done right.
And I would say, I think during a pandemic, everyone deserves a bit of slack, really.
No, it's a good point. I was trying to think back myself to even, you know, how we were handling the pandemic, whether it be 6 months, 9 months ago. And I think we've all learned so much that, you know, it's easy to look back in hindsight and ask why people didn't do certain things. But, you know, I'm trying to remember for myself how confusing and scary it was when it all first started to happen. I mean, remember we were like all washing our vegetable deliveries.
Mm. Yes.
You know, people just didn't know. And so, you know, it's always easy to whether it's criticize or, you know, applaud people in hindsight. But I think you're right, Zoe, that, all right, we're living through a pandemic. We'll give everyone some grace. Everyone's trying to figure this out.
Exactly.
Well, for a year with so much struggle, we were able to enjoy a few more lighter moments within the Royal Beat, including Princess Beatrice and Eduardo Mappelli Mozzi's wedding on July 18th. Really the best example of a socially distanced wedding you could have had. Very few guests were there. The photos really focused just on the couple themselves, and it was a much more scaled back production than what we originally expecting, that originally included a big bash at Buckingham Palace that the Queen was hosting for Beatrice, and in the end it was just a small wedding at the chapel in Windsor. And there was actually a wait for the photos because of course the wedding happened, and then the Queen had an intimate investiture with Captain Tom Moore, who of course raised over $100 million for the NHS.
God, was it that much? I mean, wow.
Yeah, which is just an incredible moment. And I think that was really the first time that we had seen the Queen step outside of her bubble at a time when everything had moved to virtual engagements, but for a very worthy cause and done in a very safe way. But of course, we then got to enjoy those great photos.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. And just one more thing on the Queen. I love the idea you know, she's so busy and Prince Philip has retired. But I like the idea that this pandemic has given them both a chance to actually spend a bit of time with each other. Mm. And in quite an unusual move, the Queen went to Wood Farm, which is Prince Philip's sort of private home on the Sandringham estate where he spends a lot of time. And the Queen went there, and there isn't a lot of staff there and it's not the grand house. And those two, you know, I can just imagine them sort of cozying up on the sofa, watching a bit of telly together.
Binging The Crown, perhaps.
Yes, no. Exactly. Ooh, The Crown.
Probably not that choice, but...
Yeah, we can talk about
it. No, watching the races. Yeah. Actually, there weren't any races, so what was the Queen watching?
Good question. Well, she definitely would have been able to pour over the photos from Beatrice and Eduardo's wedding. It was really, you know, we don't often get royal weddings, and it was such a shame that this happened away from everyone. But I think for a family that really has struggled with a lot of negative attention in the last couple of years, I think it was a rare positive moment for the Yorks, who'd really been through it all. And of course, Princess Beatrice and Eugenie, completely sort of separate from their own parents' problems, but unfortunately get often drawn into them through ongoing coverage.
Yeah, I mean, also maybe it was a slight solving of a problem for Princess Beatrice, because obviously her father's presence at her wedding would have drawn a lot of negative criticism given everything that he's been going through last year. And one note on those lovely photos, which were lovely, and it was very, very touching that she wore an old dress of the Queen's and she looked great and clearly very, very happy. But in the photos that were officially released, there was no sign of her father.
No, and that was
He was socially distanced out of it.
Completely photoshopped away from things. And in fact, that was the conversation that dominated a lot of the coverage of the wedding. You know, where we stand now, it's been well over a year since Prince Andrew vowed to cooperate with the FBI during his BBC Newsnight interview, and that still hasn't happened. We've of course since then heard from a lawyer representing Jeffrey Epstein's alleged victims that said it's outrageous that Andrew hasn't cooperated with US authorities despite so much time passing, and there is still continued pressure on him calling for him to do the right thing. with this pressure that clearly will not go anywhere, do you guys think that we might see Andrew actually cooperate in 2021? Or will this silence continue, this very damaging silence?
Well, I think he will cooperate. I think what's happening behind the scenes at the moment is what sort of cooperation he is prepared to give versus what sort of cooperation the US prosecutors want. And I think that wrangling has been going on behind the scenes for a very, very long time. And I suspect that the pandemic has maybe put a hold on all of this because other people, you know, have got other things to do with their time. But yes, I think 2021, we might see some sort of testimony from Prince Andrew given to US prosecutors. I don't know. I don't know whether we'll see him, you know, whether it'll be a sworn testimony, whether it'll be in court, whether it'll be a video link. I just don't know. And I think no one knows that. And I think that's probably what Andrew's lawyers... I mean, I'm sure Andrew's lawyers are doing everything they can to possibly protect him. And I do think that there was an element of, you know, internal US politics and all of this with the grandstanding and the idea that, yeah, we're going to bring a prince to justice. But... yeah, we'll just have to wait and see.
It's important to note that he denies all charges of wrongdoing, but, you know, this will continue to loom over him, especially as Ghislaine Maxwell, who's, you know, currently being investigated and set for trial in July 2021, you know, that's a story that won't be going anywhere. Maggie, what are your thoughts?
Well, it was interesting in hearing Zoe in your thoughts in particular, because for me, this is sort of the story that is always there and never goes away, but then it fades because, as we all know, working in news, you know, people want what's new, and the story isn't that new anymore. So sometimes it's not that you forget about it, but it's just there's other stories that are happening that get reported on. Yet it's so important to remember this is a massive news story with a man who is very powerful, a high-ranking member of the royal family, who is being questioned by, you know, top legal officials in the United States. This is a huge story, and so I think it's important not to let it just sort of fall away either, just because it's been around for a while. And so I'll be very curious, like you said, to see what happens next year if you know, more negotiations come out, if he does cooperate, if, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell's case moves forward, you know, what this means for Andrew. And I think what'll be really, I'm really curious to see is how the rest of the royal family reacts. You know, we saw some of it just with his daughter's wedding and some of the choices she had to make with photographs and how to sort of proceed with her life. And, you know, there'll come a point where I think we'll kind of expect the royal family to say something or do something. And I know their motto is don't say anything. So, but this one, I don't see how they're going to avoid not saying something if it does move forward. And again, like you noted, Omid, you know, Andrew doesn't deny everything. Maybe this will go nowhere. Who knows? But if it moves forward and it shows his involvement, I mean, we have to have some reaction.
I mean, I agree. And he's hired, you know, he's got a PR team behind him. He wanted to try and resuscitate his image. But the more, as you say, I mean, the Ghislaine Maxwell thing, once she was arrested, that definitely would have well, obviously it wouldn't have made him sweat, but it might have made him a bit more nervous.
Yeah, I think as both of you point out, this isn't going anywhere. And I think what doesn't help his case is this sort of insistence from his lawyers saying that he has offered to give a witness statement. I think they claimed at one point that he had tried to give a witness statement 3 times. But we then hear from people like the US attorney, Jeffrey Berman, who pulled together a press conference to accuse Andrew of falsely portraying himself to the public as eager and willing to cooperate. And I think there's only really one way to address this, and that is to actually do something rather than remain silent. You know, it's never too late to do the right thing, and I think his evidence would help many of the victims who are really trying to find peace and justice in what has been a really horrific journey.
Definitely, and that should be his primary objective, I would say. And it may well be, but it's one for the lawyers, isn't it?
Well, after heading back to the US at the end of March and beginning their new lives as non-working royals, but very busy working individuals. Mm. This was also the year that we saw the Duchess of Sussex get her voice back. And I think we heard from Meghan more than ever in a number of speeches, including speaking up for the Black Lives Matter movement at her high school graduation speech in June.
The only wrong thing to say is to say nothing. Because George Floyd's life mattered, and Breonna Taylor's life mattered, and Philando Castile's life mattered, and Tamir Rice's life mattered. And so did so many other people whose names we know and whose names we do not know. Stephon Clark, his life mattered.
I think what was great to see in these moments with Meghan was that she was really able to speak up at times that she felt were important, whether it was standing up for certain social injustices, of course encouraging Americans to vote, something that was considered quite controversial over here, despite not actually picking a side in the upcoming elections.
Yeah, I think the controversy was, in part, it was understandable because they weren't outright backing any candidate. And they did, obviously, Harry and Meghan choose their words very, very carefully as part of their agreement to uphold the Queen's values. They did try very hard to remain apolitical. But we all knew what she was saying. And to some commentators over here in the UK, that was a step too far. And I think that will all come down to personal preference. And a lot of it was, you know, whether you liked Meghan in the first place or whether you didn't. And you could see that the divide was the people who had an issue with her continued to have an issue with her. And I think that goes across the board on many, many things that she and Harry have spoken up about. People who have an issue with them will criticise them for certain things. And the people who support them will carry on to think that they're doing fabulous, wonderful philanthropic work. And at some point, it would be really nice for those two sort of polars to find some common ground. But like the rest of the world, I mean, it's like a microcosm of the polarisation of politics, basically the pro-Harry and the pro-Meghan camp versus the pro... I mean, that is insane to me, the Cambridges versus the Sussex camps and what happens online when you read those accounts and who supports who and what they do and the lengths that they go to and just like the passion. I mean, I find it actually quite scary.
I think you make such a good point because I remember when I went back, you know, I think I saw the headline for this story first. And at first you hear, you know, if royals are sort of outspoken politically, I think that would be very jarring. That would be something that kind of goes against, you know, decades, if not centuries, of how the royal family acts. And so you're maybe concerned at first. But then when you went and read, actually, what they said in that video, they never once mentioned a candidate's name. And Omid, I think we talked at length about this. I believe it was just they talked about like voting for decency. Now, you can interpret that, but that's someone's interpretation. And so, Zoe, I think I 100% agree. People, I think, go into this with having already made their decision about what they think about someone. And no matter what that person says or does, they'll sort of leave feeling and thinking the same.
Yeah, I think...
But interestingly, also, sorry to interrupt it, Omid, but interestingly on that, I think the key reaction was that of President Trump, who said, oh, I didn't know she was nasty and stuff like that. I mean, President Trump clearly understood Meghan's comments as being vote for Biden Harris. And that's that, you know, that's important.
What I think was easy to see during these speeches was that, you know, this was a couple that had previously been frustrated and not being able to speak up at times when they felt it was just important to get up and out there and encourage others to either take action or to spread a word of positivity. And I think the best example in that was just how quickly Meghan leapt into action during the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement, which an incredibly important moment in time and of this year, and one that we didn't see any other members of the royal family acknowledge. And in fact, there were some commentary over here that considered perhaps it was a political issue that we would never see royals talk about. But I think this is Harry and Meghan really highlighting the difference between taking sides in politics or being too political and simply standing up for human rights or what is right. And by speaking up regularly, we've also really been able to get a really strong picture of what it is that Harry and Meghan want as part of their legacy, this sort of brand Archwell non-profit organisation that they're building. Without actually revealing the projects, we do have a really strong idea of what it is their values are and how they're going to work with those over.
But yeah, I mean, as far as Meghan's speech, which she gave to her old high school, it was obviously very heartfelt. But this is a cause that's incredibly important to her. She was the first member of the British royal family to be biracial, and you know, there was this whole debate over the racism that she may or may not have experienced, or that she felt she'd experienced. Certainly Prince Harry felt that she had been the victim of racism, and has very, very publicly spoken about that. So, and then she got home to LA and it was just blowing up around her, wasn't it? I mean, and so in a way it was obviously very important for her to talk about it, but also she was in the right place at the right time, and for her not to have said anything would have been utterly impossible.
I think you make a good point. It's all those times where, similar to what we were just speaking about, where you need the royal family to say something, yet their precedent is we don't say anything. And so in this situation, when you have someone like Meghan, who, you know, I'll never forget when we were on that, and Omid remembers, we were on that South Africa tour, and it was sort of, she gave her first speech at the township, and she referred to herself as a black woman, and it definitely was something that you could tell this was going to be, you know, obviously her, not only her identity, but something that she really wanted to make herself known as, and is something that she was going to take seriously, and you know, champion causes that revolved around her and how she had grown up and what she believed in. And so then to be thrown into this situation that was happening in America, you know, like you said, Zoe, she couldn't not say something. But I think if she had been a working member of the royal family, perhaps she would have felt more like her tongue had been tied. And so to all of a sudden have this have the option and the opportunity to sort of speak what was on her mind, it must have been very just opening for her and freeing, I could imagine.
Yeah, I think being back in the U.S., as you said, Zoe, right, being in the right place during these moments, not just during Black Lives Matter, but of course for the upcoming election. In fact, during her conversation with Gloria Steinem, I think Gloria later shared that Meghan had told her that she had come back to the US to be able to vote. And I think that was, her really sort of stepping outside of her royal family role, even if it's no longer a working role, and just as a woman that is proud of the country that she comes from and stands up for the issues that affects that country. And I think that's why sometimes it was hard to really understand where some of the criticism came from, because it would have been more odd to me had she have not spoken about these things, or at least shown some kind of interest.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, one thing that we got very used to the sight of this year was seeing members of the royal family at work, but via the computer. I think I've seen the Cambridge family on Zoom more than I have my own family in the last 6 months. But you know, this became the new normal for the royal family. They were able to continue their work and do it in a way that still had impact. It was obviously a little challenging after a while for it to look different to the previous engagement, but they were still able to get
that. It was good. We got to have a snoop inside the palaces a bit more, didn't we? We got to see lots of different backdrops. You know, saw what books they were reading.
That was
different
fun.
Rooms, different. No, it was good. But my favourite part about that all was Princess Anne teaching the Queen how to use Zoom on one of them. She sort of interjected and said, "Oh no, we do it like this, Mummy." And she, and the Queen was quite abrupt. "I know."
Duty and glimpse of the mother-daughter relationship there.
Yeah, exactly. And also, and then there was another call that she was doing, the Queen was doing, for, I think it was the 150th anniversary of KPMG, the accountancy firm. And then she had a technical glitch and one of the chaps couldn't hear her, and she was talking.
She worried
in,
she'd
and then,
lost
then
everyone.
Said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I lost you, ma'am." Yeah, exactly. But she
I'm so
that
glad
one out
you mentioned snooping around royal residences, because I think that was one of my favourite things about all of these royal Zoom calls. Noticing all of the sort of tchotchkes in the background and just the interesting decor choices by certain members of the royal family. I particularly
Well, did you have any favourites?
Certainly, yeah. No, Prince Charles has a thing for squirrels. Like, he is really into squirrels. If you look in the background of any of his offices or any of the rooms that he's in, there is, like, a model squirrel, there are pictures of squirrels, there are squirrels everywhere. And, listen, I don't blame him.
Maybe it's one of those things, you know, he made a mistake of telling his mum or his sister that he liked squirrels, so now every Christmas he gets a squirrel something or other. Anyway, we know what to send
absolutely.
Him now.
Yeah, exactly. I thought that it does make me think all of a sudden when you're just, you know, it was this glimpse into the royals. They're just like us, right? Like the page of Us Magazine, River Magazine does that. And you see this glimpse into their lives and you're like, oh my God, when I'm doing my work calls from home, don't you guys ever worry about like what's in your background? And I just wonder how long they painstakingly like put together their Zoom backgrounds to make sure that they were okay. I mean, you have to imagine that there was like an entire royal consultant that came in to make sure that the Zoom backgrounds were perfect.
Or maybe it was just a really good screen.
Yeah, exactly. Or like one of those fake... I would have loved if they had popped up with a fake photo.
I love that. The queen with the...
Yeah, they should offer like royal backgrounds. We're going to have to take... We should take a photo and then we can all have those backgrounds.
Great idea.
This is a total tangent, but... This is a total tangent, but I was just reading an article about how new companies have started to pop up, and there's one that's popular in Washington, D.C., where you say, oh, I need a collection of 15 books. I wanted to make it seem like I'm smart and conservative. And they'll send you 15 curated books that put in your Zoom background. You've never had to read them or anything, and it's just a bookstore kind of adopting with the times. So now I'm so curious, you know, what was real in the royals' backgrounds? You think they hired this company to come in and be like, right, I wanted it to look like I'm an environmentalist that collects squirrels. This is my background.
I think my favorite behind-the-scenes photo that was shared during that time was Clarence House put out a picture of Prince Charles doing one of his earlier Zoom calls. It was just after his battle with coronavirus. And it was a picture of him at his table, I think in his study, but his laptop was on top of a box and a few books. And it was exactly the kind of setup that I think we've all gotten quite used to, with the sort of finding the perfect angle for a Zoom call in the past year.
He's working the angles. You think they got ring lights?
One of the first royals that we saw really stepping outside of the virtual engagements was Prince William, who visited the Oxford Vaccine Group Unit at Churchill Hospital in June. And that kind of really sort of set a new way of working for the Cambridges, a mixture of virtual engagements, but also trying to be out there as much as possible. And in a year where we saw the size of the pool of senior working royals get smaller than ever, it was really up to the Cambridges to do as much work as possible during the pandemic. And I think we saw them do pretty much everything throughout the past 9 months, whether it was clapping for carers on TV shows or tying in Princess Charlotte's birthday with delivering food packages to the vulnerable on the Sandringham estate. They've really tried to be at the heart of the pandemic and, of course, acknowledging all the work being done by those on the front line.
Yeah, and we saw a lot more of the children, frankly, than I think maybe we would have done had there not been a pandemic. We saw lots of photos and we saw lots of very, very sweet videos. I think the all-time favourite has to be the one where they were talking to David Attenborough, and that's when we heard Prince Louis talk for the first time, and that was pretty good.
That was a really cute moment from the year.
And I think, of course, we saw all of this culminate with the grand royal train tour that had kind of popped up out of nowhere. I mean, I'm sure it was in the works for some time, but there was very little word from Kensington Palace in the build-up to this announcement. And then suddenly, it's a three-day, I think, I don't know how many hundred-mile trip around England, Scotland and Wales, thanking those at the heart of communities who had helped others during the pandemic, frontline workers, emergency workers, retail workers. And it was a very well-intentioned trip. But of course, it was the first time this year that we saw a real mix of positive and negative coverage from the Cambridges, even with senior politicians in Wales and Scotland refusing to acknowledge their arrival due to the restrictions that those countries currently faced at the time of the couple arriving, and questions over whether it was actually necessary for them to be there.
essential travel only, and was that essential? Yeah, I mean, as you say, it was a lovely idea, and I'm sure that they thought they could go around and, you know, sprinkle some festive cheer all over the place. But was it a little ill-advised, given what everyone was going through? And I think the main, one of the main things that they were criticised for is people hadn't seen their family for a very, very long time. They hadn't been able to travel around, and they hadn't been able to connect. And then to see royals sort of flouncing in and out at will, I mean, it would have hurt. Imagine if you hadn't seen your, I don't know, your elderly grandmother for 6 months, and then you see her meeting the Duchess of Cambridge. You're like, well, actually, I think she'd probably rather see me than you, or not, who knows. But I can understand why people were upset with that, and especially if you are, as you said, it was Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, and also the First Minister of Wales, who were having a tough time keeping people at home or keeping people away from travelling around and mixing. And then, you know, to say people, well, actually, no, you can't go anywhere, but these guys can, it did put them in a slightly awkward position, I think.
I agree. I think people are just so sensitive right now too around, well, this is a high stress time for everyone. And then when you add in...
Speak for yourself, lady! I'm fine!
Don't you notice that? You know, you got the holidays, you got a pandemic, you got tier restrictions. Everyone's exhausted of it at this point. And yeah,
it's relentless. I agree.
I think, Zoe, that reaction is perfect. That's exactly how everyone feels.
Very relatable. I think this has been a year that has actually been pretty good for the Cambridges, given that there's certainly been some negative moments. Certainly, if we cast our minds back to the end of March when Harry and Meghan stepped away from the firm, and there was that perfect opportunity for a show of support from the royal family during the Commonwealth service. That, of course, turned into a very public icing from the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge towards the couple. There had been some moments that I think that the Cambridges perhaps didn't come out as well as could have been, and I think the royal train trip is one of those. But I also think that this has probably been one of their best years when it comes to asserting themselves as proper forces within the firm. I think we've heard from Kate more than ever. She's actually stepped outside of talking about how keen she is to do things to actually doing them. And I think as William has sort of stepped into this much more statesman-like role in the last few years, we're seeing Kate finally catch up with him. And I think that that now presents what should be a very exciting new chapter for the Cambridges as they sort of take their steps higher up the ladder within the firm. And of course the Sussex is leaving a very big hole that needs to be filled.
Yeah, I think on that note, don't forget William launched the Earthshot Prize, which we'll see what happens, but it is certainly something that he personally obviously feels very strongly about, and was projected by Kensington Palace as being a very, very big deal, and something that, you know, even would be relevant to Prince William's legacy. I mean, this is a very, very long-term project, and obviously a subject that we know both he, Prince William, and Prince Harry, and Prince Charles all care very passionately about, which is trying to protect the environment and sort out the world. I mean, and all of them have been very vocal about the idea that the more that man intrudes into nature, pandemics like this will occur. Mm. So, you know, they were right, and it's about time. And we should all start listening to Prince Charles, because he's been talking about this for a very, very long time.
I know, I did love his recent interview he just gave, where he was talking about how, you know, being a young man in 1970, this wasn't a very hot topic to be passionate about, but kind of look at it now, everybody. That's my, he didn't say that, that's my interpretation of it, but kind of like, you know, it may have taken the world 50 years, but look who's cool now.
Exactly. I think, didn't he say something like, everybody thought I was a bit old?
Yes, yeah.
I'm curious to see and looking forward to seeing the Duchess of Cambridge's work really coming to life next year. Mm. Of course, we've heard a lot about her interest in the early years arena.
People often ask why I care so passionately about the early years. Many mistakenly believe that my interest stems from having children of my own. And while, of course, I care hugely about their start in life, this ultimately sells the issue short. parenthood isn't a prerequisite for understanding the importance of the early years. If we only expect people to take an interest in the early years when they have children, we are not only too late for them, we are underestimating the huge role others can play in shaping our most formative years too.
And of course, we had the five big questions survey, the survey itself and the results of that survey this year. And this is all sort of building up to what Kensington Palace is saying will be kind of a lifelong project for her. And we'll see the first announcements from that in 2021. So I think all eyes will be on them to see what they're planning to deliver in the next year. They've certainly held an audience in the UK that is predominantly positive and enjoys the work that they're doing. So I think this is a great time for them.
Yeah, I think it makes a good point, Omid, because it's, even as we take a look back at 2020, it was obviously dominated by all of these major news headlines. The pandemic, you know, made the whole world stand still, including the royals. So a lot of the projects they were working on may have either had to take a back seat or just didn't get as much press as they may have. Like you mentioned, Earthshot, Zoe. I think that could be something that is huge. And yes, it did get, you know, a decent amount of press attention, but when you're competing against a pandemic, and it's tough to make headlines in 2020. So I think it'll be really interesting to see, like you say, Omid, going forward in 2021, what are some of the new headlines that they make? I think you make a good point with Kate. She really kind of found her voice this year and was doing more and more engagements. I'm hopeful, I'm excited that as we sort of are continuing to deal with the pandemic, we do hopefully have this light at the end of the tunnel, and that maybe the second half of next year we can start to see the royals really out there doing more engagements, maybe even a royal tour. Do we dare dream?
Maybe. Royal tour.
But I think there's a lot of excitement ahead.
The other thing that's going to, well, who knows what's going to happen next year, but which is supposed to happen next year, is of course the unveiling of the statue of Princess Diana. And both the boys were expected to be there, and this will be the first time that we'll see them, you know, very, very publicly together, and all eyes will be on whether, well, you know, what the dynamic is like.
Yeah.
Whether things have been forgiven and forgotten, and whether they'll come back together, or whether the bond has sort of been irreparably damaged, or not quite yet, or even indeed if it's possible, because who knows who's going to be able to travel. But that is scheduled for, is it July?
And we know that since March, of course, that very public departure for Harry and Meghan, things have progressed when it comes to family relations. You know, I've said this before, but there's nothing like the concerns over an unwell family member or parent to bring families together. And of course, Prince Charles going through coronavirus. And of course, we now know Prince William would have been moments where we saw Prince Harry really sort of put everything to one side and make himself available to his family and show care and be part of that. And we know that since then, a lot of the fractures within their family relationships have improved. Now, we don't know how far that is. That's something that sources have been quite tight-lipped about. But we do know this Christmas just passed. There have been gift exchanges. I'm sure there would have been virtual conversations at some point. And, you know, time is definitely a healer. And I think for a year that started out with the chaos of the Sussexes stepping back and everything that came with that announcement and that lot of hurt feelings that came with it, we now see a family that is slightly more at peace, ever so slightly, than it was at the beginning of the year. And that kind of leads us into our next subject, which is this is the year that Harry and Meghan actually found their freedom. You know, we heard all about the stuff that they, we heard about all of the stuff they wanted to achieve and why they were stepping back.
Is that a very subtle book plug?
Listen, people questioned me why the book was called Finding Freedom. I remember when it was announced, people said, how insensitive to be releasing a book called Finding Freedom when there are much more important things to be finding freedom from. But to the Sussexes, I think this journey to actually find a place where, you know, as Meghan has said, you know, they weren't thriving. So to find that place where they can thrive, where they can be themselves, where they can carry out the work, but still be respectful at the royal family, everyone had so many questions about these things. And now, as we reach the end of the year, we really see that they did actually achieve what they set out to do. And they clearly are in a much better place than they've ever been as the Duke and Duchess of Sussex.
Well, I know, and good for them. I mean, I just think at this, after all the, let them just be happy. Let's just, you know. And I really hope
they are. Yeah, and I think we've certainly seen them take on work that is very much in line with the things that we, I guess, all predicted or thought that they would be doing. We've had, of course, this huge production deal with Netflix. They have an unnamed production company. I'd imagine it probably will have Archwell somewhere in that title, that is currently working on projects that will be coming out in 2021. We've got the Spotify deal. That's a multi-year deal that will see them providing podcast content for that platform. But I think one of the things that's been exciting to see them have the ability to do is to fight back against inaccurate reports or things that they want to speak out against. Because, of course, one of the things that made them so unhappy within the institution was this never explain, never complain mentality, the no comment approach to any kind of negative or inaccurate reporting whatsoever. And we see them fire back pretty quickly these days.
Yeah, it's true. They do seem to have, well, I think you can say that they're much more in control of the narrative, which must have been what was driving them round the twist, not being able to, especially for someone like Meghan, who was used to, when she was a TV star, being able to control the narrative. And she had her blog, and she could, you know, she had a very carefully cultivated image, and then suddenly that was no longer in her hands. And that must have been very tough.
As we kind of think about what are going to be the big headlines in 2021 as well, I keep forgetting how many legal cases we should be hearing maybe as soon as next month or in the upcoming months. So I think that'll be something to keep following as well. And I do wonder, you know, how these court cases play out, what the ramifications will be, and how it will impact not only other royals, but also other celebrities and the coverage that they're either allowed or not allowed to receive by papers here in Britain.
We hear lots of people talking about or trying to sort of analyze what it is the couple meant by wanting privacy or more private lives. I think people have argued, is it a private life if you are working with Netflix or you're sharing snapshots of your life through some of the other work that they're doing? But I think it's important to note that I don't think they've ever wanted to disappear. I don't think they've ever wanted to actually be private citizens, but I think that they've always wanted to draw the line on when intrusion or dealing with inaccurate reports is acceptable and when it's not. And they seem to be clearly unafraid to pull the trigger when it comes to knowing where their rights are and where the law has been broken. We've seen them fight back against paparazzi photos. That was one of the things that people really worried may be an issue for them when they moved to Montecito. And of course they dealt with that when they were living at Tyler Perry's home. And in fact, it's mad to think that they've lived in four homes this year. That's a lot of unsettledness and chaos that has finally come to a very peaceful point. And I think we really heard that in the first episode of their Archwell audio series with Spotify. I think both of them sound very happy and relaxed. Well, with 2020 slowly disappearing into the rearview mirror, I think something that's quite welcomed by most of us, it is hard to predict what 2021 has in store. We are in very unsettled times. But there are a number of royal milestones that we'll be looking out for. It will be hard to know how any of these are celebrated. We've got Prince Philip's 100th birthday in June. Can't quite believe that that's even happening.
Wow.
But that's a grand age. Will he, do you think he'll receive a letter from the Queen?
Bloody well should.
I hope it's hand delivered.
And then of course we have the Sussexes.
Exactly. No, Maggie, you mean footman delivered.
That's true. Yes, how could I? Of course.
And then we have the Sussexes 12-month review at the end of March. That has come around very quickly. But I think if we look at the work that Harry and Meghan have done, they've clearly achieved what they wanted to do. It's, I guess, now a case of finding out if everyone is happy with everything. And that
imagine
will...
if they have another, like, imagine this is another sort of astonishing decision and they're like, no, actually, we're coming back. Start getting Frogmore ready.
That would be very unexpected.
I'd be quite happy. I would be quite happy because when we looked at, you know, it was towards the end of the Cambridge's Royal Train Tour and the senior working royals all met in the quadrangle at Windsor Castle. So we had the Queen and we had the Cambridges and we had the Wessexes. And it just didn't look the same without Harry and Meghan. It looked like a slightly, and obviously it was quite a somber occasion because we're all in a pandemic, but it's, I don't know.
I guess that should be our honourable mention and highlights of the year. This has really been the year that Buckingham Palace have tried to push the work of the Countess of Wessex and Prince Edward, who have very much been in the background, but with such a small group of senior royals left, we've now seen them sort of take, I wouldn't say fill the void left behind by the Sussexes, but certainly add to the numbers. And it'll be interesting to see if that continues in the year ahead. But of course, it wouldn't be a royal year without more babies. We have Princess Eugenie's and Zara Tyndall's babies on the horizon. So at least we'll be getting some portraits. I can't think of the next wedding now. We really have no more weddings until the Cambridge children grow up, which will be...
They better hurry it up because I missed my royal wedding this year, so...
So I've got to ask you guys, we've gone through the headlines of 2020, but what were your personal favourite moments from the year?
Ooh... I know mine. It was recent. I'm probably stealing what yours was, too.
Well, let's go to Zoe first.
Because you know what I'm about to say.
No. You go first. I'm still thinking.
Well, I can't help it. My favorite is when Camilla brought her dog to the dog home. And they had the dog pull the curtain thingy back. But in order to have him do it, they tied a sausage to the end of it. And the dog pulled on the sausage. It was just everything. I was like, this wins. That's like my favorite news story of 2020. I mean, let me just explain it again in case someone missed it. Someone in that, you know, royal group tied a sausage to the end of a curtain. Just like, think about that. Like, who had to tie the sausage to the curtain? Like, what were they thinking about when they tied the sausage? Was it raw? Was it cooked? And then Camilla came over there with her dog and had her dog pull on the sausage to pull the curtain. I mean, to unveil the plaque. It's just, it's really everything.
I think all other plaque unveilings are shook and will never be the same again because...
They'll never be the same. It's like, if you don't have a dog and a sausage,
I think they're going to have to up the game, like just bring different animals. It's going to end up with an elephant peeling back a curtain at one point.
What a cute little British hedgehog.
We have certainly seen more of the royal pets this year. We also, of course, had royal pet losses. The Queen is now down to one doggy. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge lost Lupo this year at just 9 years old. So it will be interesting.
Yeah, there was a bit of mystery surrounding Lupo, why Lupo died, wasn't there? Did you think he got run over?
He certainly was younger than expected, and Kensington Palace haven't given any further insight into it. But I think what was really interesting about that moment was that the Cambridges, I think, at this point, have certainly made themselves more approachable with the public, and you know, to see them jump onto Instagram in the way that perhaps other celebrities or other high-profile individuals do, to share the news of that with their own message alongside of it, showed that we might see them perhaps slightly more within arm's reach in the year ahead. Because I think before we'd kind of seen them stay away from adding their own content to social media.
I'm still trying to think of my favourite moment. There were just so many.
I know, I was like, Zoe, I'm waiting. I feel like you're going to have a good one.
No, I think my favourite was, I've already used it up, was the idea that Prince Charles is holding out and he doesn't have a mobile phone.
Oh, that...
He must must be so annoying. Imagine if you're like late to meet him and you're like, oh, I can't tell him I'm late.
I can't even text him and he's waiting on you.
Well, how does he take photos?
Oh, what's your favorite? Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. Does he still have a camera? Like a real camera?
That you have someone else always on hand. That's the follow-up question.
Yeah, fair enough. He has a human, a professional.
Or he has a little just mobile phone carrier who walks around with him everywhere. Oh, it's not my phone, it's his.
the perfect excuse.
This is what I'm
guessing. I think my favourite moment was actually very recent and perhaps the best one to close out this end of year special on. It only took place yesterday on the first episode of Archwell Audio Podcast. And it was hearing baby Archie wish everyone a happy new year.
Archie, is it fun?
Fun.
Fun.
Off to me. Ready? Happy.
What? Happy.
New.
New.
New. Year.
Yay.
Baby.
I mean, that was just to me. I mean, you mentioned Zoe earlier in the show, that moment when we heard Prince Louis speak for the first time and they made that video asking David Attenborough questions for his newly launched Instagram account. And I just think there's something about cute royal baby voices that I am weak for.
Well, how does everyone...
You know what, Omid, that's a really good
one. American twang?
I thought it was so ridiculous,
like it.
That there's so much focus on how a child's accent may or may not appear in three, perhaps two and a half words. I mean, New Year kind of blended into one word. He lives in the US, he has an American mother. I would perhaps argue that even if he was living here in the UK, if he was living at Frogmore Cottage, children often adopt the accent or some of the accent from their mother, who they spend the most amount of time with.
Wait, how would you say it?
Happy
how
do
you
year.
Say New Year?
Well, I think you should all know that my 3-year-old doesn't wish people a new year. He wishes them a new ear.
See, that's... Oh, my God. All right, well, now that wins. That wins.
It's always really interesting to hear what everyone else's favourite moments were, and that's exactly what I asked on Twitter just before we recorded this. A slightly overwhelmingly high number of responses, so apologies if I don't get to read them, but it was really interesting to see just how different everyone's highlights of the years were. Brutus's mum said, seeing Meghan sitting in her backyard in her new Montecito home with a floppy hat on her head and a smile on her face talking to Gloria Steinem. To me, that said, she was happy, relaxed, and glad to be home. Many of you picked this as your favourite moment, including Lexistential, that said the Endeavour Awards. That night was magic. Of course, that is the night we had the iconic picture of Harry and Meghan under the umbrella just days before they officially moved away from their senior royal roles. Ian Mason 11 says the Queen knighting Captain Tom was his favourite moment, had a lot of those. Luna said Harry and Meghan believing in themselves and putting themselves first was one for them. In fact, hundreds of you said the moment Harry and Meghan stepped back was your favourite moment, royal moment of the year. Mally Poulton says the Queen reassuring the country, the voice of reason, trust and hope, the glue that keeps us together. And Holly J said, the Duchess of Cambridge's Hold Still project. We had quite a few for that. She says it portrayed the whole of 2020 perfectly. And in fact, those pictures really did sum up certainly the UK and how it dealt with the pandemic, not just on the front lines, but at homes as well. And one more, let's pick one more. Laverne Mars, this was actually another great one that also I'd add to my list of favourites, was the Sussexes matching the Sussex Squad fundraiser for CAMFED. CAMFED catalyses the power of the most vulnerable girls and young women in Africa, helping them with education opportunities. And the Sussex Squad earlier this year raised tens of thousands of dollars for this initiative. And the Sussexes matched that donation at the same time. Lots as well, talking about the Archwell podcast. Moments with the Cambridge Royal Train Tour was also pretty popular. One more. Citygirl684 said the story of love that Harry and Meghan's hand-holding told, especially during their last engagement at the Royal Albert Hall. Of course, we mentioned that earlier in the show. Harry received a huge standing ovation from the entire military veteran community. And that just about brings us to the end of the show. I mean, it has been quite the year, quite the ride. So much more still to come. I promised myself earlier this year that I would no longer use the word unprecedented, because I just feel I had beaten that word to death. But I think as we step into 2021, we will continue to have those first moments of royals doing things differently as we continue to adopt to the current situation with the pandemic, which changes by the day. We are currently in very high levels of restrictions here in the UK, and that will continue to impact the work that the royals do. I'd love to see a royal tour on the cards, but it's also hard to picture when that will actually be, with the vaccines rolling out so slowly around the world.
Yeah, also we're gonna see which royal's gonna get the vaccine first. My money's on Prince Philip, obviously, but
Oh God, that's a really good question. I bet the Queen. But
maybe they'll do it together. Two for the price of one. They use the same vial.
Are you guys making New Year's resolutions this year?
But you're right, that will be a big moment.
No.
No, I just want to keep living.
Stay alive.
And I think that's everyone's resolution, you know. Find the positive, keep connecting with people any way that we can, and managing to have some fun in midst
absolutely.
Of
I think there's, I haven't thought what about it. You? I know there are certainly, after watching the royals navigate this year, I think that keeping calm and carrying on is a double-edged sword, so I'm not going to follow that one. I think there are times where we've really seen that work to their advantage, and there are times where it's also really done them a disservice. For me, I don't know. I'll continue wearing a mask and maybe take up puzzling. You've inspired me, Maggie.
I'm just telling everyone, puzzling's changed my life in the last week, and I highly recommend it as we go into 2021 still in lockdown. I'll trade puzzles with you, but as I told you, they have to be good ones. I like detail, I like people, I like a lot of pieces, and fun.
Well, Zoe, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. You've got to come back for another one very soon.
I would love to. Thank you very much for having me.
I know, Zoe, I love catching up with you.
Thanks, guys.
And a big thank you to all the listeners of the AirPod. It's been so fun to have you guys tuning in every Friday, sending all your lovely tweets. So yeah, do stay in touch if there are things that you want to see or hear more of in 2021, then let us know. You can either tweet myself at Scobie or at Maggie Rooley. Just use the hashtag #TheAirPod so we can find it. And of course, I've got to say a big thank you to the guys in New York, Mike Dubusky, Leighton Schneider, and Anthony Alley for pulling together the show every week. And on that note, I think stay safe, everyone. Look after yourselves and each other. And we will catch you next Friday in the new year.
In the new year!
Have a good one.
Happy New Year, everyone.